Uvaser basad treifa lois hechelu lakelef tashlichun oisai. This pasuk teaches us the iser of eating treif. Now, the word treif is a word that's taken on a life of its own. In the vernacular, be that English, or really I mean, it comes from Yiddish, the word treif has come to mean food that's not kosher. Chazer is treif, right? When there's an expression in Yiddish, something is chazer treif. It means to say it's very, very treif. And so, you know, chazer and nevela and bas b'chalav and, you know, food with the hechsher from the other rabbi that you don't like, all that is called treif, right? And then we can call a mitzvah treif or an erev treif or somebody's opinions treif. All of these are expansions of the use of the word treif. The truth is that a chazer is not treif and nevela is not and bas b'chalav is not because the word treif is from the word in the pasuk, treifa. And it doesn't mean non-kosher food. It's one very specific type of non-kosher food, of certain kinds of mumin that are in the behema, makes it a treifa. There's really, I guess, four main categories of meat that isn't kosher, treifa being one of them, then there's nevela, which means meat that wasn't shechted or didn't get a proper shechita, so the chicken that you'll buy in, you know, in Stop and Shop or, you know, any goyish store, it, chicken is a, you know, kosher bird, but the iser is mishum nevela. Then there's behema temeya, right? So pork you don't eat because it's behema temeya, and bas b'chalav. Bas b'chalav is it's a meat, at least a meat recipe, which is usher. These are each one is a completely separate area of halacha, a completely separate part of machalas asurais. But the word shreif has come to mean all of them, all the non-kosher food. Now, the reason this happened is because in the Al Tehaim, the shailas that came to the Rav in Hilchas Kashrus were almost all treifa shailas. Because a balabasta would take a chicken, the chicken would be walking around in the backyard. She'd take the chicken, she'd bring it to the sheikhet, or she would go to the chicken store and she would buy a chicken, and she would take it to the sheikhet. The sheikhet would shecht it, and then she'd bring it home and have to examine the animal, the chicken, in some cases, it's a behema. It was mostly chickens, I think, that the house, you know, would be the household badika, but the sheikhet, for his part, the butcher, would be shechting a behema. And you have to examine the internal organs. What is treifa? Treifa means some kind of injury or defect in the internal organs, mostly, that render the animal non-kosher. So these shailas would only surface upon autopsy. You have to shech the animal to get to the shaila. Behema temeya shailas don't come up because the sheikh knows what to shech the only shaila. I mean, occasionally there were big discussions in the Paiskim, you know, a certain animal that was new to the area, and they would argue about whether it is kosher or it's not kosher, but for the most part, right, like turkey, for example, but for the most part, the shechtim, they shechted the same animals every day. They knew, you know, cows they shechted, pigs they didn't shecht. So behemoth temeya shailas didn't come up. They didn't have to go to the Rav with the animal and say, is this a behemoth temeya? Nevela shailas could come up. That's, you know, I mean, Jews know, kosher, you know, consumers know that you don't eat game that you shot dead. That's nevela. But shaila could come up if a sheichet does a shechita, and it's not a perfect shechita, and then he has a shaila about the shechita. But that's also much less shchiach. We've been studying the shechita mumchen hein. For the most part, if a sheichet is doing a shechita, he knows what he's doing. The shechita is done right. So those shailas are not so common.
So if he finds the knife not being sharp, is that treifa?
That's nevela. If the knife was not properly sharpened, then that would be an avela issue. Yes, but the bas b'chalav, okay, you know that you could have anachanami, but the vast majority of the shailas were treifa shailas. After the animal is shechted, and then they're examining the internal organs, and they discover some kind of a defect, some kind of a injury that may qualify as one of the treifas, they have to bring it to the Rav. The Rav would have to examine that piece of meat, part of the animal, and paskin, kosher, a treif. So when the Rav would tell you that the food's not kosher, the word that he used was treif, because that's what the shaila was about. So from there, the word came to have this much broader application. And of course, nowadays in America, things are quite different. We, you know, the average person never has a treifa shayla. All of these things are taken care of in the shlachtos. We get meat that's on a piece of styrofoam and shrink wrap, and it's very unusual to have a treifa shayla. I say unusual, it's not impossible. There are certain situations where broken bones that you find in your meat are alarming. But I think people in the know say, and I'm really not, I'm not giving any halakha advice on this, but the vast majority of those things happen in the processing, in the packaging, after the animal was shechted. But theoretically, if a chicken had a broken bone, depending on which bone it is, had a broken bone while it was walking around on the farm, then it may be a treifa. So sometimes an educated consumer might come to a rav with a piece of chicken and say, look at this bone structure, tell me if you think this is a problem. But for the most part, the broken bones that we encounter are, I think, post-shechita, and therefore not an issue. So nowadays, the treifa shells are not really common, but that's what treifa means, and that's, you know, that's why it came to take this expanded meaning. So the actual meaning of the pasuk, the words uvaser basoda treifa lesechilu. So how does the word treifa come to mean this? You know, we're saying that it refers to a variety of defects and blemishes and injuries. How does the word come to mean that? Vaser basoda treifa. Treifa really means torn apart. Like when Yaakov Avinu said, "Taref teraf Yosef," that Yosef was torn apart by a wild animal. The word treifa means torn apart by a wild animal. So the Torah is saying, "Baser basoda treifa." If an animal was torn apart in the field by a wild animal, you had a sheep and it was attacked by a wolf. So that's what the Torah calls a treifa. Mm-hmm. But Chazal understood, the Torah Shabbat Peh taught them that the wild animal wasn't the siba. The fact that it was torn apart, that even though that's the way the Torah describes it, but it really shouldn't matter whether it happened through a wild animal or it happened from a fall or it happened from an illness. The point is that it has such an injury that it would get from a wild animal. So the wild animal is just an example, a dibra kasav bahayveh, but the point is that it has such an injury that that's what makes it into a treifa. So Chazal understood that basar basoda treifa is really a colorful way of saying an animal with a serious injury or defect. And when we say serious, the way Chazal would mishayar, that was that type of an injury or defect that would prevent it from living 12 months. That makes it into a treifa. And if it wouldn't do that, then it's not considered a treifa. So that's the taich of the words basar basoda treifa. But the pshutishal mikra, it really, even, you know, the simple explanation of the lav, we say that it means, you know, meat from an animal with a defect, is already a step away from the actual pshutishal mikra if you're just translating the words. Translating the words, it sounds like it means a sheep that was attacked by a wolf. Really, the wolf is completely irrelevant. La halacha, it means a sheep or cow or chicken that has a defect. So the words of the pasuk are, you know, a little bit misleading. The way the Mechilta explains this pasuk, it says that this is a classic example of a dibra hakasav bahiveh. As the Torah was just using a usual case to give you an example of a defective animal. But the truth is that it goes even much further than that. That which this pasuk is an example of a pasuk that really contains much more than meets the eye. Because it's, you know, you read it and it's basar basoda treifa, it sounds like a sheep that was attacked by a wolf, and really doesn't mean that. It really means an animal with an injury. But really, it's much more than that. Because Chazal say that there are four or five, maybe five, separate isurim that are included in this pasuk because of the diktuk halashin. In fact, the Sefer HaChinuch, there's a beautiful piece in the Sefer HaChinuch, which is really a very general description of Torah, of psukim in the Torah, but he writes it over here because it's particularly apt for this pasuk. He says that whenever you're learning Torah, so you realize that there's a pnim and there's a chutz, that the simple reading of the pasuk, the pshutishal mikra, is the levush. That's the clothing of the pasuk. And then there's a pnimius, the inner, that's the deeper meaning. And he said, and they're both right, and they both have to be learned. He gives a mashal of a royal presentation where the levush is all Big day sheishu meshi verikma tahirim, very expensive embroidery and silk fabric. And the inside is zahav rav pninim, is gold and jewels on the inside. So he says the lashon of a pasuk is also like that. So over here, the levush of the pasuk is that it's the iser treifa. But the pnim of the pasuk is that it's more than that also. Because one thing that we left unexplained is, why does it say basadeh? So again, dibar kasav bahaveh, that's where a wolf would attack the sheep. But considering that the wolf and the sheep are not really important for the halach over here, so why did the pasuk say basadeh? So Chazal say that the word basadeh, sadeh means in a field, meaning outside. It's really a mashal for any time that an animal is outside of where it's supposed to be. Sadeh means on the outside. So any animal that was yoytze chutz l'mechitzasai, any animal that went out of its boundary is included in the Yisr Treifa. What does that mean? It went out of its boundary. So let's say it's kachim. Kachim have boundaries. Kachim have to stay within the Azara. Kachim kalim have to stay within the city of Yerushalayim. So kachim sheyatzu chutz l'azara, or kachim kalim sheyatzu chutz l'chayma, that's called animals that are chutz l'mechitzas, and outside of their boundary, they're included in the Isra Trefa. If you eat that meat, you're violating the law of basa basa de trefa lo sechelu. Now, those are examples that aren't again nowadays, right, because they're kachim. A third example, by the way, in the same that I would put into the same category is a Karban Pesach, sheyatzu chutz l'chaburasai. This, within carbonates, there are three categories of boundaries. Kachim have one, kachim kalim have another. And then in carbon pesach, although that's also kachim kalim, but it's has a lot of specialized halachais, a carbon pesach has to stay within the chabura. So pesach sheyotza chutz l'chabura side, that also is a violation of the same law. Now all of those are kachim, they don't apply nowadays. But there is also an example of meat that was yotze chutz l'mechitzase that does apply nowadays. Not that it's such an everyday case, I don't think, but the Chazal talk about the following. If a shechit shechts an animal, and the animal is pregnant, right, a pregnant cow, so that shechita helps for the baby cow also. I mean, as long as the baby cow was in the uterus, even if it was fully formed, even if it was ready to be born, so theoretically, you could then deliver the baby, and it'll be a whole cow with the head attached. Mm-hmm. The cow is kosher. It's because sure. it's a part of the mother, uber yerech imai, and the mother was shechted. But if that uber was hoitzi yodoy chutz l'rechem, if it stuck any part, says a hand, a foot, a leg, whatever, if any part of the animal went out of the rechem before the shechita, so then that's aser because of the din of chutz l'mechitzasai. Basar sheyatzu chutz l'mechitzasai. And if you eat it, you're over on the lav of treifa. Even though it has no shaychus to the conventional treifa. It's not injured, blemished, sick, right? Nothing like that. But it's basar sheyatzu chutz l'mechitzasai. All of these are included in the Isra treifa. So you have the classic treifa, and all these examples of basa shiyasa chusl mechitzasai, these are all violations of the law of basa basa de treifa leisechelu, which then gives rise to the question of, so does it become a law shabaklolos? You know, sometimes you have a law that asks for so many things, so there's a rule, the Gemara says in Psachim and elsewhere, that a law shabaklolos ain't like in a law. For example, there's a law I don't remember the lashon of the lav. Leseichel al adam. Lashon of the pasuk leseichel al adam. Now that's an obscure pasuk to begin with. Like, what does that mean? Leseichel, don't eat on the blood. So the Gemara says that it asks a lot of things. One of the things that it asks is to eat from the meat of a korban before the blood was sprinkled on the mizbeach. It also refers to types of achilas that have nothing to do with the actual food. It teaches us that there's no sudas havra'ah for haruge beistin. Usually when somebody dies, there's a mitzvah to make a sudas havra'ah for the avelim. But for Haruge based in, there's no mitzvah to make a Suda Savra, to make them a special Suda for the Avelim. You don't eat on the blood, meaning the blood that was shed by the based in. It is also, and that's an Isser Derei, so let's learn from that pasuk. There's also an Isser of for the Ziknei based in, for the Dayanim on the based in, that they're not allowed to eat on the day that they carry out an execution. The Dayanim have to fast on that day. L'seichel al-adam. So there's a lot of things there's others also. A lot of things that are included in that Isser, but the halach is that you don't get malchus for any of them.
This is all considered the same derais?
Yes, they're derais. These are Yisrum derais. And that pasuk also, incidentally, Chazal also darsha from that pasuk. The one that's actually negeya halach al-maisa is L'seichel al-adam. We learn from there, L'seichel asher tespalalu al-dimchem. You're not supposed to eat before you daven in the morning. And that's on a lower level. It's maybe an asmachta. The Rambam brings it down in the Sefer HaMitzvah. It's not so clear whether it's a deraisa or not a deraisa. But that's also associated with the same pasuk. That we have halacha l'maisa that you're not supposed to eat. Although in Shulchan Aruch there are certain kulis that are included that if somebody would have a hard time davening otherwise, then he is allowed to. But there is a halacha that at least under regular circumstances you're not supposed to eat before shacharis. And that's learned from the pasuk. L'seichel al-adam. So there's so many things that I learned from the pasuk of L'seichel al-adam, and you don't get malchus for any of them. And that's what we call a lav shebeklolos, a lav that includes so many things, you're not going to have malchus for that. So over here, there are some rishonim that say that L'seichel, the sugi of lav shebeklolos is a complicated one. The Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, he already divides, he's the first one that talks about it, and he divides it up into three or four categories, the different types of lav shebeklolos. And the consensus of the Rishonim is that for treifa, you definitely do get malchus, but for all those other things that we mentioned, the basar sheyatzeh chutzal mechitzaseh, which we said there are really four examples of that, basar sheyatzeh chutzal mechitzaseh, some Rishonim hold that for that you don't get malchus, because it's a lav shebeklolos. Some Rishonim hold that no, you do, and they differentiate between this lav and the lav of l'seichel al-adam. But al kapanim, it's questionable whether you do, but because there are so many things that are learned from here. So again, like the Sefer HaChinuch was saying, it's a very rich pasuk. This pasuk, you know, the pshut shel mikra is almost irrelevant to the real meaning in halacha. And in the real meaning in halacha, there's one primary meaning of which is what we call treifa, and a whole bunch of others, basar sheyatzeh chutzal mechitzaseh, which are also learned from the same pasuk. Now, the pasuk, okay, so then the pasuk says, you're not allowed to eat it. So what do you do with it? Akalav tashlichu noisai. You throw it to the dog. Now, here again, how, you know, just like in the first half of the pasuk, we were talking about how literally do we take the pasuk, right? The Mechilta said, Dibar Kasav Bahayivet, we don't really take it so literally. What about over here? Is this a real mitzvah? Do you have to throw it to the dog? The treifa?
First you have to buy it.
Because you have to buy a dog.
Actually,
I'm a kind that mitzvah every day.
Yeah, that's right.
Every day. Actually, I have a dog.
You don't buy one every day.
No. Okay. I'm a kind that mitzvah
every day. Do you feed a treifus?
What?
Do you feed a treifus?
Yes.
Probably not. Probably just
Nevelis. No, not
probably Nevelis. Not treifus.
Right.
So the puzzle says, like, the shlichon right? Say, and, okay, let's mention, the Mechilta, which Rashi brings down, says, why did the Torah say to give the treifa to the dog? The Mechilta says, because, like, HaKadosh Baruch Hu schar kol bria, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't forget any favors. If someone does something nice, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is grateful and gives them the reward. And by Yitzias Mitzrayim, all the tumult of the Chipazin and the Yad Rama when the Mitzrayim were dying and the Yidden were going out, and the dogs didn't start up with any Jews, which is a big deal because, you know, Jews are scared of dogs. So if the dogs weren't barking at the Jews, I mean, some kids in my family wouldn't have been able to leave Mitzrayim if the dogs were barking. So it's no small thing. But the Torah says, because Baruch was like, so the Torah said, that when you have a treifa, you feed it to the dog. So what does that mean exactly? There's a Rashi and Chumash. Interestingly, there's different editions of the Rashi and Chumash. It really depends which Chumash you're using. Mm-hmm. In some Chumashim, there's a longer version of the Rashi, which seems to make it clear in the Rashi itself that it's not meant as, it's not meant literally, it's not meant as something that you're actually supposed to do. In the standard, I think the article Rashi has, I don't remember how it's written, but there's an extra line, the article Chumash has a version of Rashi that has a line that's not in most of the standard Chumashim, at least most of the older Chumashim. I'm not sure where those lines come from. But it's unclear, but there is a Rashi in Psachim that actually, Psachim Daf Chav Beis, that actually he calls it a mitzvah. He says, L'mitzvah se itzrech, l'ashlichay l'kelev. The Rashi is, it's what?
You mean l'mitzvah se, like to be from a chathchila, or means from a kind of mitzvah?
He means to do the mitzvah, meaning that the pasuk is coming to tell you what to do with the treifa. That's what the words of Rashi sound like. Without going into it's a little bit of an involved shaklavataria. Excuse me, Rashi was explaining why the Gemara needed an extra pasuk to teach us some other halacha that it was working on over there, was coming to teach us how we know the chametz is asav hanah. Wanted to learn that from there, and the Gemara and the Gemara needed the word oisei for Rashi. Why need the word oisei? Why can't you learn from the pshut shulmikra? And Rashi says the pshut shulmikra is the mitzvah say istrech lahashlichay lekalav. It's for the mitzvah throwing it to the dog. And over there, the Tosfos, not the Tosfos on the page, but in some of the Balei Tosfos, they ask on Rashi, what are you talking about? The mitzvah say there's a mitzvah to throw it to the dogs? There's no such mitzvah. Now, it's interesting. Tosfos Rosh asks this kash on Rashi. He says, Rashi calls it a mitzvah. There's no such mitzvah. And he asks this, like he refutes the Rashi without bringing any proof. Usually, when Tosfos comes to argue on Rashi, he'll say, Pirush or Kuntres, Rashi said such and such. V'teima, because we find in this Gemara or in that Gemara, he doesn't bring anything. He just says, there's no such mitzvah. Now, there's a pasuk that says that you do it. Rashi just brings down the pasuk and says, he just takes the pasuk at face value. And the Rashi says, oh, come on, everybody knows it doesn't mean that. So what was the basis for this kash that the Rashi is asking? So the answer is that the basis is Maisim B'chol Yohim. And it's important to point out that this Maisim B'chol Yohim has been the basis of the whole kosher meat industry for many, many centuries. And that is that every kosher shlachtos is connected with some goyish butcher. So that because when you shecht a cow, every time you shecht a cow, you don't know what's going to happen because all the treifas are on the inside. And, you know, it's really like doing an autopsy. And then you're going to discover, you might discover a treifa. And a cow is an extremely expensive animal.
The rear portion of it.
What?
Yeah, the rear portion.
Right, for that matter, the rear portion also. But, okay, that's true. That's more true nowadays. In the olden days, they weren't giving away the whole rear portions. They were doing the nikur. But there was always the risk of a treifa. And that would be a major loss. And it would make it almost... prohibitively expensive to shecht animals. So the way they got around that was that they always had a partnership with a goyish butcher, and they would sell the treifa to the goyim. So at the price of kosher meat, but at the price at least of non-kosher meat, it wouldn't be a total loss. And that's what made it sustainable to have a kosher meat industry. If you're telling me that there's a mitzvah l'kelev tashlicha noisai, that when there's a treifa, in particular, remember, we said there's a lot of kinds of non-kosher meat, but particularly about treifa, if there's a mitzvah l'kelev tashlicha noisai, that means you can't sell it to the goyim. Then you can't check the animal, because there's always the risk that it's going to be a treifa. So the meisim b'chol yoyim, that was really what made the whole industry work, was that they sold it to the goyim, and they violated this supposed mitzvah of al-kavad ha-shlichon ha-yisai. Now the truth is, there's a very fascinating history to this. There was, when the Yidden came to Ashkenaz, which is not so long ago, we're going about 1,300 years back. Before that, the Yidden really they lived in the Middle Eastern countries, Eretz Bavel, and then from Bavel, when the Muslims conquered Bavel and they expanded and built a whole empire, so the Jews moved around, all along that empire. But then there was a small group of Jews that were taken up north into northern Europe, and that was the beginning of Ashkenaz. And that was really the beginning of the Jews living among the Christians. Now, at least that far back, they had this point of contention, because the policy of the church towards the Jews was that the Jews could be tolerated, meaning official policy was Jews are allowed to live in Christian lands, but with a very strict rule that they can't, that they that there has to be a clear hierarchy of who's better and who's worse. I mean, it has to always be clear that the Christians are superior to the Jews, and under those circumstances, the Jews could be allowed to remain in Christian countries. But if the Jews ever occupy a position of superiority over the Christians, then that, you know, then that interferes with this whole, you know, that like violates the condition, and then they're not supposed to be tolerated anymore. So now what does that mean, a position of superiority? So, you know, there were people that were interpreted it, you know, more l'chumra, and others that interpreted it more l'kula. The more benign Christian rulers said, okay, that means that you can't have a Jewish governor or mayor. You know, he can't be in charge of the Christians. There were others that interpreted it more strictly, that a Jewish homeowner isn't allowed to employ a non-Jewish nanny, nurse, maid in his house, because that's also a superiority, you know, in the hierarchy. So that was a constant point of contention. One of the areas where this came up was in the meat industry, because the Jews wanted to sell the treifas to the goyim. But there were some galochim that said, wait, you mean the meat that's not good enough for the Jews is good enough for the Christians? That means that you're putting that by definition is placing the Christians in a position inferior to the Jews. We're getting your refuse. So the galochim said it's not allowed. The galochim, there were some priests that tried to enforce that the Jews should not be able to sell their treifas to the Christians. And then the people that supported the Jews, which tended to be the upper class, the nobility, that they were the ones that had an interest in the economy working, and they recognized that the Jews were an asset, so they wanted to make the Jews more comfortable. So one of the things when they were negotiating with the Jews, this was one of the things that they would talk about: will you or won't you have the right to sell meat to the Christians? There's a very fascinating document that still exists. One of the earliest documents on this inyan is the Charter of Speyer. Speyer, right? We talk about the Kehillei Shum. The three earliest Kehillei of Ashkenaz are Shum, Speyra, Vermeisa, and Magencia. So Speyra, which is Speyer, it's a city in Germany. I think in the year 1084, there's a charter in which the bishop that owned that city invited the Jews into his city, and there's a document that he made, a shtar, in which you see that the Jews were in a strong negotiating position. They were able to say, you want us, you know, it wasn't like they were coming to beg for permission to be in the city. They were saying, you want us to come, these are the conditions that we have that need to be met. And this charter says the Jews will be guaranteed this, and they'll be guaranteed that. So one of the guarantees that the Bishop of Speyer makes is that they'll be allowed to sell meat to the Christians. So, you know, without any context, you read that document, it's like, it's strange. Like, why, you know, why was that such a big issue? So this is the backstory. Because, first of all, there were people that asserted it, right? The Galachim were saying, no, it shouldn't be allowed. And the Jews needed it because the Isser Treifus made the whole industry so risky that they needed to have a partnership with the Goyish butchers in order for it to work. Okay, There's a Gemara in Menaches that says, it brings a pasuk, you know, we started off with the pasuk in the Torah that says, The Gemara in Menaches says, brings a pasuk in Yecheskel. Over there it says, I think, Kol Nevela, or Kol Nevela Utrefa La'oifa La'behema, Lo yichlu hakayanim. Kayanim are not allowed to eat nevela and treifa. So the Gemara over there is the kasha. Kayanim who do lo yachli ha Yisraelim achli, right? Or Zarim achli. Are non-kayanim allowed to eat nevela and treifa? Why is the pasuk in Yecheskel singling out kayanim and is nevela and treifa? So the Gemara says, because salgadai dechamina, hoyol v'ishtri legabayhu besar malika, oif malika, so you think that it's mutter kamash malon. So what's this, malika? When a bird would be burned as a carbon, or many carbonates that had to be a bird, when a bird would be brought as a korban, the kohen would slaughter it, sort of, would detach the head through a process that's completely different than shechita. It was done with his nail, first of all, and it was done from the back of the neck, not from the front, which was totally not shechita. But that's what the Torah says you do with a bird that's brought as a korban. And then the meat of that korban will be eaten by the kohanim. So the kohanim are allowed to eat malika. Well, once the Torah says they're allowed to eat the oif of a malika, so you might think, now that's, you know, under certain controlled circumstances, right? It's only within the Beis HaMikdash, with the Basar Kachim. But once the Torah says that, so you might have expected, okay, then they're not so makbanon, the kohanim don't have to be makbanon this halacha. So you'd think that it's altogether mutter. So that's why the Pasuk in Yechezkel comes and says that no, kohanim are also included in the Isser. The Gemara doesn't really spell this out, but I wonder if that means that maybe in the times of Yechezkel, there was actually maybe a debate about this, that there were kohanim that were saying we're allowed to eat nevelis treifis because look, we're allowed to eat malika, and Yechezkel came to dispel that idea, and that's why he wrote this pasuk. That it doesn't say in the Gemara. The Gemara just says that we would have such a havamina, so the pasuk in Yechezkel comes off, we get that havamina. But pasuk pshat in the Gemara, coming from our perspective, meaning we're having a shiur today about treifa in particular, the Gemara doesn't make any sense. The Gemara, the Pasuk in Yechezkel mentioned two isurim, nevela and treifa. And the Gemara says, why did it have to say that they're also to Kahana and they're also to everybody? And the Gemara says, well, you might have thought that it should be mutter because of malika. Which isur does that address? That's nevela. Malika has an isur nevela. So I understand there's a havamina that kahanim shouldn't be included in the isser nevela, but the Gemara didn't provide any basis for a havamina that kahanim shouldn't be included in the isser treifa. So how did treifa get addressed over here? This Gemara, l'chayr, what's going on in this Gemara? This Gemara is one of the makayres. I don't know if anyone brings it as a makar, but l'chayr, this Gemara is one of the makayres for a big chiddush, a very big lamdish chiddush that about 100 to 150 years ago, the big lamdanim of the Dar said this chiddush. I say the lamdanim. It's funny. It appears in the Svarim of a lot of different authors that maybe all said it simultaneously. It's Reb Chaim says this chiddush. That's meaning Reb Chaim Brisker, although it's not in his sefer, but his son, the Brisker Rav, in his sefer, he quotes from his father Reb Chaim as having said the following vart. Reb Yosef Engel. Reb Chaim was, of course, a Litvisher, Reb Yosef Engel was a Polisher, but also a same exact time period and a tremendous Gain and a tremendous Lamdin. He says this Vart, Reb Chaim Eiser, without quoting any, Reb Chaim Eiser is really the following Dar, but he says it on his own also. And the Vart is as follows. The Iser Trefa that we're saying is an animal that was shechted, and then you examine it and you discover that there was some kind of a flaw, some kind of a blemish that renders it a treifa, so you're not allowed to eat that animal. So the conventional wisdom would be that it has nothing to do with the Isser treifa. It has nothing to do with the Isser nevela, meaning nevela is defined as an animal that's not shechted. This animal was shechted. There's nothing wrong with the shechita, but it's asr anyway. Not all shechted meat is kosher. Like, for example, in every animal that we shecht, there's the chelev, there's the dam, and there's the gid anasha that you're not allowed to eat. Now, no one would suggest that those things have an isser nevela. They're perfectly well shechted. There's no isser nevela. You're just not allowed to eat them because there's some other isser chelev, dam, gid anasha. So, by the same token, treifa, I would have said that they're perfectly well shechted. There's nothing missing in the shechita shabai. So there's nothing to do with the Isser Nevela. There's just some new Isser that the Torah made up called an Isser Treifa. But then there are a couple of Makayres that are suggestive that it really is connected with the Isser Nevela. And what it revolves around is the Isser Nevela, so this is sort of, you know, usually overlooked when we talk about it nowadays. We're really only interested in the Isser Veheter aspect of it. But Nevela also has a whole different aspect. Nevela is also Metame. The meat of a carcass, an animal that died, is metame, right? Similar to the way a human being is metame, of course, on a much higher level. An animal that dies is also metame, but not if it's shechted. And it, meaning, of course, right, the meat that we eat is not metame, right? You're allowed to eat meat, even though it's dead, right? By definition, meat is always dead. It's not metame. But nevela is metame. The Gemara in Chulin Daf Ayin Dalet says, well, what about treifa? Is treifa metame? And the Gemara says, no, the shechita helped to be metaher it midei the tumas nevela. And the Gemara brings a pasuk to teach me that the shechita helps for a treifa to be metaher it. So Reb Chaim, Moshe, Reb Yosef Engel, they all ask, why do I need a pasuk to teach me that treifa is not metame? Why would I ever have a mina that's metame? Let's go back to the examples I gave before, like chelev and dam and gira nasha. Anyone have a havamina that those are metame? They're not. Nevela is metame. This is not nevela. It's perfectly well shechted. Why is there a havamina that will be metame? What you see in that Gemara is that treifa is not a completely separate isser in the way that chelev and dam are. Treifa is like a shtik nevela. It's like a tilde of nevela. Nevela means an animal that wasn't shechted. Treif is an animal whose shechita did not complete its heter. It's a deficiency in the heter of the shechita. When an animal is a good, full, healthy animal, you shecht it, it becomes kosher. When an animal is a treifa, is an unhealthy animal, so then you shecht it, but the shechita doesn't work. The shechita fails to be machsheret. So what you're left with is an animal that doesn't have the heter shechita, which sounds like nevela. It's almost nevela. Nevela means it doesn't have any shechita at all. Treifa means that its shechita failed to be matiret. It's a chesaron in the heter of the shechita. That's the chiddush that they were machadish. Again, this gemara that I mentioned about the havamina that should be metame being one example of it. There's a Rambam that's really on a different topic. He's talking about the shechita of a goy. And he says, now, a goy is pasul shecht, right? So the shechita of a goy is nevela. But the Rambam says a big chiddush. He says, Yiroi Ali. Whenever the Rambam says Yiroi Ali, that means it's his own svara. He doesn't have any kerf for it. He doesn't have a right to it from the Gemara. And there's a hasagas haravid over here where the Ravid, you know, the Ravid's always criticizing the Rambam, but over here he pays him a big, big compliment. The Ravid says on this Yiroi Ali, he says, this svara is the worst svara the Rambam writes in his whole sefer. I think it's a big compliment because it's not such a bad svara. But the Rambam writes Yiroi Ali that this, and we're a little bit off topic here, but I'm just going to like say quickly, that the shechita of a goy is no good. It's no good to be matir b'achila, but it helps to take off the tumah. Midei writes it helps to take off the tumah, and the Rambam says, and where do I ever find such a thing? Just like treifa. So Reb Chaim said, look at that Rambam. He says just like treifa is an example of a shechita that helped to take off the tumah. Help to take off the tumah. What do you mean? It has no tumah. It has no sheiches, right? It's not nevela. It's a shechted animal. No, you see over there that it's that the isur treifa is a chesaron in the shechita. That the shechita fails to do its job completely, but it did its job partially. It took off the tumas nevela. It just didn't take off the isur nevela. So you could think of treifa as being like a tilde of the isur nevela. And if that's true, then that Gemara in Menaches makes it, the Gemara with the Pasuk in Yecheskel makes perfect sense. That, right, the Pasuk says, the Yecheskel says that the Velu Trefa lo yechlu akehanim. So the Gemara said, why is this lo yechlu akehanim? No, because I would have thought that it's mutter because they have a heter in Malika, so I would think they have a heter in Nevela. So we were bothered that, okay, so the Gemara addressed Nevela, but the Gemara doesn't explain Trefa. The answer is that if Nevela was mutter, Trefa would automatically be mutter. Because treif is only usr because it's almost as bad as nevela. But someone who's allowed to eat a nevela is kosher getting allowed to eat a treifa. So that's what could be the pshat in that Gemara. But on Kabbalah, you see this idea.
But it's two separate lavim and tayr.
It's true, right? It's two separate lavim because lemaisa, it does have a shechita. If tayr just said nevela, of course we wouldn't include treifa because treifa does have a shechita. But by writing the lav of treifa, the Torah was telling us that even though there's a shechita, but over here the shechita doesn't complete the het, it doesn't do the job. So that's the newest development in the sugya of treifa. This is a chiddush that was said 100 years ago, 120 years ago, whatever. Now, okay, I went a little bit out of order. I meant to.
Lemaisa is not something you're saying.
Right, the halacha that's not matame, meaning because the shechita helped partially, it took off the tumas nevela, but it leaves you with the iser. Going back to the halacha, I just forgot the order that I wanted to go. When we were talking before about like halacha shlichon, I say, so we came out that no one really holds that there's that you really have to do that, even though there was a Rashi and Pesachim that sounded like that. So I didn't mention the Sfasemis actually says, if you look very carefully in the Rashi, that Rashi, the following Rashi, it's the Mavur that Rashi only meant it in a Havim, he didn't mean it in Lamaisa. The Rush says that such a thing can't be. Lamaisa, no one says that you really have to throw it to the door. But the Mechatz Chinuch says, nevertheless, that the Mechatz Chinuch has a discussion about whether it should count as a mitzvah, this Lakal of Tashlichon Ayse. Does it count as a mitzvah? He brings down that Taisus in Yuma says that it's a mitzvah. He says most of the minor mitzvahs don't count it as a mitzvah. Then he writes, he's searching and searching through the minor mitzvahs. You know, we usually think of when we talk about, you know, the people counted the mitzvahs, so the names that come to mind are the Rambam, the Sefer HaChinuch, the Ramban, because, you know, we often talk about the Ramban on the Rambam, Sefer HaMitzvahs. The truth is that there were many, many minyanei mitzvahs, because there was, once upon a time, there was a style of, I don't know if style is the right word, but it was a thing to write a piyut with the minyan of the 613 mitzvahs. Probably the most famous example is Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon's minyan of mitzvahs is a poem. He has a minyan of mitzvahs, a sefer mitzvahs that's learned, but it's a poem. It's about 613 lines long. Really fewer, because he sometimes throws a few mitzvahs into one line. But in poetry form, you know, with, I don't know, maybe it's like 500 lines, you know, he goes through the minyan of mitzvahs. It's just a list of all the things the Torah says to do and not to do. And he wasn't the only one. So there is, in the Machzor, if you open your Shavuos Machzor, the piyut for Musaf, meaning it's not a yitzer, we talked about this a few months ago, it's not, we shouldn't call it a yitzer, but colloquially we call them all yitzres. So if you say yitzres by Musaf, really they're called Musafim, the ones by Musaf. If you say the Musafim on the first day of Shavuos, just a little Eitzateva, if you come to the early minyan, nobody says the yitzres. The early minyan on Shavuos morning. But if you look in the Musafim, for the first day of Shavuos, the piyut is, it begins atahin chalta, and it goes through the 613 mitzvahs, which makes it pretty long for a piyut. Again, it's short for a sefer mitzvahs, but it's pretty long for a piyut that is said, and it's in the big letters. It's not, you know, one of the tiny things that nobody says. Anyway, the Mechatz Chinuch refers to that piyut, and he says he counts like kelav tashlichon oisai in his minyan mitzvahs. He has a line in the poem that goes, Trefa, he has, you know, the poem is going in alphabetical order. I think he goes through it like five or six times, like five poems that go from Tuf to Aleph, and then by the end of all five of them, so what is this, only about 100 lines or so, and then he's done with his 613 mitzvahs. But there's one line that says, Trefa lahashlech unavela limkar. That's the lashon that he writes. The Mechatz Chinuch says he's the only one of the many mitzvahs that I found that counts like how the shlichon I say as a mitzvah. Now, but when he's discussing, so that, and then he says, and there could be a nafkamina from this, because that means that it's a lava asay eating treifa, and that it could affect things like asay dechalei. I don't know if he mentions. I don't think he mentions asay dechalei, but I'm just throwing in. It could affect asay dechalei sasa, because an asay is doicha alone loy sasa, but it's not doicha loy sasa asay. It could affect. He mentions a different nafkamina that gets a little bit more involved. It could affect whether you have a heter of shalei kederach achila, which is very nigea la halacha. The medicines that we take, we generally rely on a certain kula that shalei kederach achila is only midrabanan, and once it's midrabanan, sefer achila we're matra. That's a gemara psachim daf chav dalet. But that's because anything that the Torah expressed b'lashon achila, shalei kederach achila isn't included in the yisur deiraisa. But if the Torah expressed the Isser Achila with the Lashon of Lakela Tashlichon Aisai, so then it wouldn't qualify for the Heter of Shalek Derech Achila. So if you have a pill that's, if you have a pill that's made with Chelev, or that's made with a Dug Tamei, so that, right, yeah. So then it's okay, Shalek Derech Achila, it's a Chela. But if it was made with a Trefa, then maybe it would be worse if this is really a separate mitzvah. That's the Mechatz Chinuch's discussion. But let's just clarify. When he says, when he's having this discussion about whether the Kevla Shlichon Oisei counts as a mitzvah, he doesn't mean a mitzvah to throw it to the dogs. That's for sure there's no mitzvah to throw it to the dogs. He knew full well that every shlachtism where he bought his meat, they sold the shreifas to the goyim. And that wasn't a violation of a mitzvah. What he meant was, does the Kevla Shlichon Oisei count as a mitzvah, meaning an iser asay not to eat it? In the first day of the pasuk, the Torah says lo yisechelu. So if you eat the treifa, you are over a loisaset. Then it says akel tashlichon oisai, which implies and don't eat it. Throw it to the dog or do something else with it, but don't eat it. That's the implication of akel tashlichon oisai. So then, if you eat it, you're violating that asay. So if you count it as a mitzvah, then the achila of the treifa would be a violation of a leitzas of asay. If you don't count it as a mitzvah, then it's just a leitzas. That's the Mechatz Chinuch's discussion about is it a mitzvah, is it not a mitzvah. But he's not discussing whether it's actually a mitzvah to feed it to the dog. Now, coming back to the topic that we started with, right? What is the treifa? So we talked a little bit about what it doesn't mean, right? It doesn't just mean non-kosher food. It has a more specific meaning. And what it is various kinds of injuries and defects that an animal has. Now, okay, we're not going to go into what they actually are, but there's a list. The Rambam, the Gemara, really starts with a list of eight, and it expands from there. And the Rambam puts together a list of 70, and then he adds another couple, so it's really 72 altogether. Of mumen that are considered treifas. They're missing organs or damaged organs, organs that have a hole, broken bones in some cases. There's a list of about 70 or 72 blemishes that are on that are considered treifas. Then the Rambam writes, and remember, these are all things that Chazal were mishayer that they would interfere with the animal's ability to live for 12 months. Then the Rambam says, okay, what happens if there's a conflict between this and real life? Real life meaning what you see the animals doing. You know, do they live, do they not live? What does the veterinarian say is going to happen with this blemish? The Rambam says, so the Rambam speaks out, this is at the end of Perek Yud, if I'm not mistaken, in Hilchos Asuras. The Rambam speaks out in both directions. He says that sometimes, you know, if you have one of these mumin that Chazal say it's not going to live, even if the doctors say, no, it is going to live, you're still not allowed to eat it. And then the Rambam says, and let's say there's a blemish that it's known through the Darkei HaRefuah that the animal is not going to live, but it's not one of the things that was listed by the Chachamim, then you are allowed to eat it. And the Rambam says, because al zeh nemar al pi hadavar sheyirucha, that you have to follow the Torah the way Chazal instruct you. Now, what's this Rambam telling us? So some might read it to mean that the Rambam is saying that we don't care what the doctors say, the doctors know what they're talking about. We just listen to Chazal. Chazal tell us that it's a treif, because Chazal knew better. The Chazonish says that if you read the Rambam very carefully, he says, I think the Rambam is saying just the opposite. The Rambam is Bedafka not saying that we don't listen to the doctors because they didn't get it right. The doctors may very, the Rambam says, even though it's known midachei refuah, the animal is going to die from this within 12 months, but if it's not one of the things that the Chachamim counted, you're allowed to eat it. He doesn't say because it's really not going to die. It's known midachei refuah that it's going to die, but you're allowed to eat it anyway because the halacha is al pi hadavar sheyirucha. So the Chazonish says, so first of all, he says that the Rambam is not saying that the doctors don't know what they're talking about. He's saying that even though they know what they're talking about, but the halacha in this case doesn't follow what they're saying. Now, what's the rationale for that? If treifa is supposed to mean that it's got a fatal wound, and we have modern medicine that could advise us about what is a fatal wound and what isn't a fatal wound, so So why do we follow the old list of 70 blemishes that the Rambam lists, right? That which comes from the Gemara. Why don't we just go to the vet and ask the vet, is this straightforward or is it not? So the Chazon Ish, he tries to tackle this question, and he theorizes as follows. He makes two, he posits two chidushim, and then based on that, tries to explain this. The first is that there's a couple of Gemaras, and interestingly, really ties in with what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. There's a couple of Gemaras that indicate that there are different stages in history that were meant to play a different role in the development of Torah. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about the Gemara that says, Rebbe Reb Nosson Seif Mishnah, Ravina Ravashi Seif Hayra. So that means that they were the Seif of something, right? That something changed after that time. He doesn't, and in this place, the Chazon Ish doesn't try to elaborate on what exactly changed, which is what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. That's not his concern over here. The Chazon Ish just says that you see that there are tekufos in the history of Torah. There's another Gemara that's even more dramatic. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Tes that says, Shisa Alfi Shana Havo Alma, that's the very well-known part of the Gemara. The world is, there's a 6,000-year life to this world. And then the Gemara breaks it down. And the Gemara says, Beis Alafim Toihu, Beis Alafim Shal Toira, U Beis Alafim Shal Mashiach. So from the 6,000 years, the first 2,000 years were just Toihu, nothingness. The second 2,000 years were Toira. And the final 2,000 years are Mashiach. Now, all the parts of this Gemara are, you know, need to be developed further, or what does that mean exactly? Certainly, what does it mean that these 2,000 years are Shal Mashiach is an interesting question, maybe for another time. But the middle 2,000 years being the 2,000 years Shal Torah. I mean, Matan Torah happened during that time, that's true, but Matan Torah just happened one day. What does that have to do with the whole 2,000 years? And Torah certainly didn't go away, Chas V'Shalom. We're way after those 2,000 years and we still have Torah. In what way was that the time of the Alpayim Shal Torah? So the Chazon Ish says that what it means is that that's the time that in which Torah was supposed to be decided what it means. That's when Chazal were tasked with deciding what Torah means. And then after that, it means what Chazal decided during that time. That's the time in which the pshat in Torah is solidified, is set.
That's about Chesimus HaMishnah, right?
Right, it ties in very much with the Chesimus HaMishnah discussion. Mm-hmm. Now, the other chiddush that he says is that the understandings that we have of the natural world, right, the development of science, it's not by accident, right? Clearly, there, you know, nowadays, we know, I mean, it's funny, we were talking about the Rambam is the one that wrote that, you know, scientists nowadays, you know, will give you different opinions and they may be right. The Rambam was in the 1100s, Seif Kol Seif. Nowadays, the understanding of the natural world is very, very different and much, much more advanced than it was in the times of Chazal. But the Chazon Ish says, that's not accidental. Obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is all about Hashgacha Pratis. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was deciding that, you know, for different periods in human history, it was appropriate, for whatever reasons he saw fit, that they should have a more limited understanding and a greater understanding. He throws in for good measure that it hasn't been a straight progression in one direction, because once upon a time, there was such a thing as a Sefer HaRefuah. It's that Chizkiyo HaMelech was Goynez, and that means that once upon a time, there was much greater medical knowledge, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided, I mean, Chizkiyo decided, but I guess HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Hizkim al Yadai, that should be taken away. And then there was a dark, you know, what we call the Dark Ages, of a few thousand years. And now there's an enlightenment. But all of that doesn't happen by accident. The Kadosh Baruch Hu was gazed that there should be an enlightenment. So it was Bahashkacha Pratis that at the time in the Alpayim Shal Torah, they should have a certain degree of understanding of medicine. And the Hashgacha Elyoina, for whatever reasons, wanted Hilchas Treifus to be nikva based on that level of understanding of medical knowledge. The Torah didn't want Hilchas Treifus to be nikva based on the most perfect medical knowledge possible. It wanted Halacha to be nikva based on that degree of medical knowledge. So that's Hilchas Treifus. That's the Chazon Ish's explanation for why the Rambam says, and this is right, what we follow, that Hilchas Treifas, the Hilchas Treifas of today really are very detached from the actual health and longevity of the animal. But they're the halachas that were nikba based on the medical knowledge available that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made available during the Alpayim Shel Torah when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the halachas of the Torah to be nikba. Now, Treifas Lemaisa, right? We said that it's all really things that are that come up after the animal is shechted. That's when you discover the treifas. There's 70 things that could go wrong that can make an animal a treifa. So do you have to do an actual detailed autopsy to check for all these 70 things? The halacha is no. The Gemara says that roiv behemesein and treifas, and we're allowed to say mechana roiv, and therefore, even though there's 70 things that if you were to see that the animal had this hole or that hole or this deficiency or that deficiency, the animal would be a treifa, but you don't have to look for them. You shecht an animal, you can cut it up and put it, you know, package it and sell it. You don't have to worry about any of these treifas. Except, Zakti Gemara, except on the lungs. Because holes on the lungs are more shchiach, are more matzoi, and therefore that you do have to check for. And then there's a whole discussion in the Gemara about how you check for holes in the lungs. Now, and the Gemara introduces something called a sircha. And a sircha is some kind of tissue that grows over the surface of the lung, like a bump on the lung.
A scab,
okay, and that indicates that there's something doing there. And then there's complicated sugyas in the Gemara about what do you do with when there's a sircha, how do you check, and under what circumstances it does make a problem, and under what circumstances it doesn't make a problem. And then there's a very, very famous line in the Ramah, this is Shulchan Aruch and Siman Lamedtes in Yeridea. So there's maybe 25 sifim over there going through a lot of different, you know, cases. If the sircha looks like this, and if the sircha looks like that, and you move it this way, and you move it that way, and, you know, a whole lot of different variables, and telling you in each case whether it's kosher or it's not kosher. And then the Ramah says that b'mdina is elu, here where we live, we don't get involved in any of them. We don't use an animal that has sircha on the lung. We want the lung to be smooth. Mm-hmm. Smooth in Yiddish is glatt. That's where the term glatt kosher comes from, right? So if it's another one of those words that's in the vernacular taken on a meaning of its own, and nowadays people think that glatt kosher really means very kosher. If you have a pizza shop that says glatt kosher is no good, because that means that whoever's giving the hechsher doesn't know what he's talking about. Glatt kosher is specifically a description of meat. It's the Ramah saying that we don't get involved in any shilas about sirchas. That's why, you know, there's the Chassid Shemaisa. I don't know. I've seen it. I think I might have seen it about Rav Chaim Sanzer, but I can't vouch for that. And whether I did or I didn't, I don't know if it's worth anything. I saw it once in print in his name. I'll just call it a Chassid Shemaisa. That one time a Yid came to the Rebbe, and he said that he's very, very sick. And the doctor said that he's for sure going to die, and he wants a bracha from the Rebbe. Instead of just giving him a bracha, so the Rebbe started asking him details. It was a lung condition, and the Rebbe was asking him a lot of questions about what the doctor said about the lungs. And then he said, Rebbe, what should I do? And he said, you should move to Tzvas. It was in Poland, in Galicia. He said, you should move to Tzvas. He said, well, why should I move to Tzvas? He said, because here in Poland, we follow the Rambam. And the Rambam says that lungs like yours are a treifa. And you're going to die. But go to Tzvas where the Beis Yosef is buried. And the Beis Yosef is much more tolerant of some of these lung problems. And over there, you can have a Refuah Shleima. And I assure you that the way it's written in the book is that he went there and he had a Refuah Shleima. I don't know. But that's the Maisa. I just want to end off with this, that I saw in the Sefer Chinuch, when there's a Machlokes Rishonim, about what a sircha means. Does a sircha, there's a machlokes whether the sircha is you meant to use the word a scab, right? A scab sounds like scar tissue, something that comes as a result of an injury, meaning that Chazal were concerned that if there's a scab, it's growing over a hole, and underneath there's a hole, and that hole that preceded the sircha is what traifs the animal. The other possibility, the way the Rashba says it, the Rashba and Shulchan Aruch say that's the other way around. A sircha indicates that there's some illness, and the illness that that caused the sirucha to grow would also cause a hole to develop. Meaning the sirucha anticipates the nekev. Mm-hmm. So it's not an indication that there was a treifa, but an indication that there would be a treifa. Now, if we're not involved in the lumdus of the sugyas of chulin, so this topic wouldn't be of such major significance. The reason why I'm bringing it up is because it happens to be a very fascinating bibliographical significance. It's a machlaikis Rashba and Ra'ah. Now, first of all, Rashba and Ra'ah, that's we'll talk about that sefer very briefly. The Rashba wrote a sefer called Teres Habayis. Besides for the Chidushe Rashba, which most of the Rashbas that you learned in Yeshiva are from the Chidushe Rashba on the Masechta that you're learning, but he also wrote a sefer called Teres Habayis, which goes through all the Inyanim of Issa v'Heter. And Yerideya is very largely based on the Rashba's sefer Teres Habayis. The Rashba was a Talmud of the Ramban. He lived in the late 1200s, and he was the Rav of the city, the Spanish city of Barcelona. The Ramban had another Talmud, also a great, great Talmud, named the Ra'ar of Aaron Halevi, and he also lived in Barcelona. They were both the Midim of the Ramban. They were both very widely respected by their peers. For some reason, they didn't have such great respect for each other. They each thought that the other was very mistaken in a lot of his halachas. The Rashba wrote this sefer called Teres Habayis, like this is the Torah for a house, right? Telling you how to live, you know, addressing all the shalas of Isra'el that come up in your house. The Ra'ah thought that there were a lot of mistakes in that sefer. So he wrote a sefer criticizing the Teres Habayis, and he called it Bedek Habayis, which means it's really a double meaning, but at least one is the inspection of the house, meaning he's going around inspecting the Rashba's house and finding all the violations in the inspection. Now, so the Rashba and Ra'ah often argue, and so they're one of those pairs of Rishonim, like Rashi Tosis, Rambam Ravid, that they always go together. When you hear one, you expect to hear the other name. But what's unique about this one, the only instance in the whole Tekufas Rishonim where you have that the dialogue went both ways. They were contemporaries, they were neighbors. The Rashba wrote the Teres Habayis, the Ra'ah wrote the Bedek Habayis. The Rashba read the Ra'ah's Bedek Habayis, and he wrote a response to that. And he called it Mishmeres Habayis, meaning in defense of the bias. And when you go out and buy a Teres Habayis, it has all this on the page. You have the Teres Habayis in the middle, and the outer margin is the Bedek Habayis of the Ra'ah, and on the inner margin is the Rashba's response called the Mishmeres Habayis. Now, in that sefer, they have this machalik that we were just talking about, what's a sircha? The Rashba says the sircha is what anticipates the nekev, and the Ra'ah argues at great length and with strong expression. No, the sircha is a simon that there was a nekev. Now the reason why this is so significant is because in the Sefer Achinuch, Mitzvah Ayin Gimel, when he's talking about treifa and he talks about sircha, he describes the sircha as something that precedes the nekev, exactly like the Rashba does. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that's so interesting is because we've talked a few times already about how the Sefer Achinuch, which is one of the most popular svarim, you know, that Klai Yisrael has from the whole Tekufas HaRishonim, and it was written anonymously, but it was long believed to be the work of the Ra'ah. Mm-hmm. Now, this theory comes from a printer. One of the printers, in the first or second time that the Sefer was printed in the 1500s, it was said on the Sharblat, Sefer Achinuch LeHara'ah Zal. The author actually, he signs his name, he writes it anonymously, but the way he signs off at the end of his akadama is Ish Levi mi Barcelona. Ish Levi mi Barcelona. Now, I guess this printer, 250 years later, how many Levim did he know from Barcelona in the 1200s? The Ra'ah was Aaron Halevi. So he assumed that it was the Ra'ah. Some say that there's also a clue somewhere that indicates that his name was Aaron from something that he writes actually in this week's Parshas Truma. You could take a look, but it's not. Others say that it was foolish to put much stock in that clue. But be that as it may, the printer called it the Ra'ah, and you know people that buy Sfarim, you can't blame them. They see a name in the Sharbot, so they assume that's who wrote it. So the Gedolei HaAchrayim referred to it as the Ra'ah. the Shach all the time, he calls, I mean, when he quotes from it, he calls it the Sefer Chenekel Hara'ah. Rabbi Kiv Eger, right? Gedele Yisrael, they considered it the Ra'ah. The Chidah came along. The Chidah was a little of like a critic, a scholar in this way. And he was, Kobel also, yeah, but he was more like kind of a scholar in researching Svarim. And he said that he doesn't think it's true. He got to the bottom of how they started calling it the Ra'ah, who made up this thing. And he said that he has a lot of evidence that it's not the Ra'ah. And he came in and said that you shouldn't think the Sefer HaChinuch is the Ra'ah. And this is one of the big rayas. Mm-hmm. The way that the Sefer HaChinuch describes the Sircha is one of the rayas that the Sefer HaChinuch is not really from the Ra'ah.
Unless he wrote it after he sold the Shmeres Abayas.
Oh, what is it?